Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate.
Now listen to this.
Adventure tonight on Soma Time. I can't believe I have this phone in my arms again. Lots to talk about. My God, it's only been a week. A nary a week since we last tried this little experiment. And I think the world has completely gone insane. It really has gone insane. So I need to get to dial up an old friend, an XO, who wants to be our friend in a time of need now. Here we are. Let's see if it'll play. It probably won't because this is the nature of the beast. Oh, you absolutely got to be kidding me. Look at that. I did everything perfect, too. Let's see if it'll work on this one. Just that sound and everything. Of course not. No, it doesn't want to work. Oh, wait, there it goes. I dig this music. Takes you back to 1986, and the world was stable. Yes, Sapiens. Before the internet, when Michael Jackson was popular, and not as weird. Let's funk out a little bit, get into the vibe tonight. We'll go into the dark side of the brain with our guests in about 10 minutes. But first, a little dance number. I like to call Flesh Out. Hey! And the number is 646-478-4847. Do you want to get in tonight? Hey!
You could have a big dipper going up and down.
This video really holds up over time. What a funkophilia this is.
Hello.
Gabriel, to get us into the mood, as it were. But if you've been watching the TV and digging all this post-Michael Jackson coverage, the one recurring theme has been our friend Deepak Chopra. I think the man has done 87 interviews in the last 4 days. And he's really trying to raise awareness about the abuse of these prescription narcotics. And let's take a little listen to what Deepak had to say, and then we have a special surprise for you maybe here. See? All right.
Yeah, I spoke to him a few times in the last 3 weeks, and then 2 days before he died, he left a message on my voicemail saying he had good news to share, and would I call him back? I picked up the message a day later. When I called him back, the phone number wasn't valid anymore, and I didn't really panic about that because he used to frequently change his phone numbers.
Can you describe how did he sound relative to your long experience with him? Was there much change indicated or none?
In the last few weeks, he sounded really good. He was very excited about the concert. He was especially excited about a particular song that he was wanting to write. He had created the music. He had sent the music to me. We were discussing the lyrics of the music. So he was in a good mood. He was in a really good mood. I said, Michael, you're coming back. He said, for sure, this time I'm coming back.
What do you make
of it? All right, well, there's Deepak then, but we actually have Deepak joining us now right here on Blog Talk Radio. So welcome to Summertime, Deepak.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, have you uncovered anything else along this case? Because it seems like it's a big controversial case that you've been making, that these doctors have been enabling these entertainers and pretty much, you know, feeding them the drugs they need to cope with their various demons.
That is right. The demons are very bad, and they are all over the West Coast, and sitting here in the lotus position, I've just had a big plate of couscous, and I'm going to now enter into the flatulent zone and deal with my grief.
Well, thanks for joining us, Deepak. Anytime you want to come back on and share, you know, that somebody else drops dead, who's looking out for Billy Mays? You know, we got all these people worried about Michael, but who watches for Billy?
Billy is in the void. He is fine. I've spoken to him several times, and Billy is okay. He actually conceded that the ShamWow was better, and it's okay.
All right, Deepak, thanks for hanging with us, and we'll get to you again the next time somebody takes a powder. There you go. So a little Deepak Chopra checking in tonight. Ah, I'm getting the fancy up here in the air. All right, so our guest should be here in a couple of minutes. We have so many things up there. I don't know what else to tell you guys. It's you know, where do you go? Do you go with the economy? Do you go with the what stuff is happening? Last week, the big story was Iran, and now we're back to Iraq. Back to Iraq. And, you know, all of that's going on, like, basically, you know, on the scroll. We got so much going on. We got this eco-son-of-a-bitch running the governor thing down there in South Carolina. Holy mackerel. Has anyone checked out that guy? I got to get his number. I got to get him on the air. He needs an eco-counseling, eco-to-eco. And in case you don't know what I'm talking about, go to somerspace.org, you fools. I've been doing this for 2 years. Somerspace.org. Scroll down right in the middle of the current homepage, which is about to be transformed again. There's a little thing that says Meet the Four Domains. You click on it, and you see the little eco kid there with the dirt in her hands. Basically, we got a biological three-year-old there running to South Carolina, and he thought it'd be okay to skip to Malou down to Argentina for 5 days. Hilarious. Oh, look at this. Look at this. Slings it over there. By the way, we have a SomaCast going tonight. The Mets have secured a victory this week, and the last time they won was when I was down at City Field last Thursday. But right now in Atlanta, two teams that I love to hate, the Braves and the Phillies are combating, and the Braves are trouncing them 9-1. But we have now gotten one out here in the seventh inning, and the Phillies haven't gotten a hit yet. So we're keeping an eye on that. It's actually two outs. Wow, two outs in the seventh. So we're definitely going to keep an eye on that because the game will probably come to a conclusion during this show. So we're going to keep tabs on that. And we've got lots of things going on. I don't know what to tell you. There's so much going on. And oh, you're killing me. There's a hit for the Phillies. I jinxed it. Damn! Oh, wow. That just really hurt. I shouldn't have said anything. Damn. That is still losing. And it's the Braves. What, am I going to cry for the Braves? Please. So, there you go.
You filthy criminies.
Damn Phillies. Mets and Phillies this weekend down at PNC Park there, and then the little bandbox where the Phillies play. So we got 4th of July weekend coming up. They got lots of things going on. Last week we had a guy out here saying you can't eat or drink anything. So if you have any questions about that show, I'd be happy to bat that around with you. 646-478-4847. Hopefully we'll have our guest calling in a minute or two, and she'll get on the air this time. There was a little difficulty last time. Otherwise, I'll have to dip out and call her as the procedure is set. But just while I'm doing this, I'm going to take a little look-see at the old email to see if she's thrown up a flare yet, because that happens. Let's see. We're checking the emails. Pet rescue. No, that's not me. You know, this John Edwards getting on my nerves, you know. John Edwards wants to... John Edward? Oh, okay. John. That was his name, John Edward. It wasn't John Edwards, huh? The guy that was talking to the dead people. Didn't know that. That was a good show. Oh, there she is. All right. So, the horn, and we will welcome in from the West Coast, where everything's happening, we have Arlene Taylor. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Okay. Any celebrities decide to leave the planet today that I know about out there? Because that seems to be the point of departure.
Boy, it does seem to be that way all of a sudden, doesn't it? Jeez.
Yeah, it's been interesting watching people sort of have the media autopsy of everybody. I mean, Farrah Fawcett, in case anyone kind of was able to pull their eyes away from the Michael Jackson case, the Farrah Fawcett case was fascinating because right before she passed away, she was going to be married, to Ryan O'Neal, and it was a whole, they had the special on about a month ago. She really went out very poignantly, and then within hours of her passing, all of a sudden this circus starts, and I don't think it's going to stop for a while. And the happiest guy in the world is probably the governor of South Carolina.
Who knows? But it's so interesting to watch how different people deal with, different events, whether they think it's sad or timely or unfortunate, but it's every brain has its own opinion.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things I wanted to get to you right from the top here is the influence of this type of media, internet, this widespread 24/7 interactive media on a developing brain and on, say, an adult brain, the difference between how those two basically different affects would accept information. Because what I see going on is the developing brains are much faster and much more able to sort the information, even though they're not necessarily neurologically equipped to process it.
Well, sure, they got less to sort.
Yeah, except less memory to sort through. And us, anyone above the age of 35 literally goes into media overload about it, and they almost get to the point where they're putting their hand out like you're pushing yourself away from the table at Thanksgiving. Enough. Yet it's everywhere. And just do you find that the media's influence on our behavior has steadily increased as the technology's advanced?
Well, I think the potential is there, Mark. Certainly brains that are not completely developed yet, which are probably something, under the age of 27, 28, and they've grown up with this type of media information, they're going to have their brain shaped to some extent by what is put into it. Because although the brain, you can't really use a computer metaphor for the brain, it's still what goes in comes out to some extent. And then you have the people who have, yes, watched some TV, but maybe they grew up like I did, for, a couple of decades before we even had a TV in the home. And so we did a whole lot more reading and perhaps, writing and listening to records and so on compared to the multimedia approach today. And a brain that's developed might be very interested in what happened, like with Farrah Fawcett's death or Michael Jackson's death. But if they've got a healthy, balanced brain, they're probably not going to obsess on it. And those are the kind of people that I see say, okay, I heard it. I've processed it. I know what I think about that. Okay, I'm done. I'm done with the input.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, that has to do a lot with the way we're sort of conditioned to process these things from the worldview we develop. And then what happens is that you get a lot of fixed perspectives about it. So as more information comes out, especially the stuff in South Carolina, because there's so many moral and ethical and behavioral things sort of embedded in the political undertow there. And the same thing has gone on with respect to the war, with respect to the healthcare issues and the economic debates. So when you're sitting at the kitchen table trying to deal with your local world, just trying to keep your family together and keep everything moving, keep the trains on the tracks, and these big social events happen over top of us, is that something that you deal with individually and personally based on your track record, or do you feed off the way other people react around you? Because, again, if it's gossipy, if it's got that mimetic juice to it, it's almost as if it has a life of its own at a certain point.
Well, I think that really depends on the type of brain that you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. You know, someone who's extroverted and likes lots of stimulation might want more data. Someone who's introverted might say, okay, I heard about it, now I want to back off and not listen to anyone else's opinion and decide what I think about it. And an ambivert would be somewhere in between. And I think we sort of forget sometimes that, you know, things like that are happening in Carolina probably have been happening in politics for at least 50 years, maybe a lot longer than that, maybe hundreds of years. However, we've not had the type of multimedia invasion, if you want to use that word, or the ability to be connected all over the world so quickly that we can even track somebody and where they're going and what they're doing. And so people's behaviors are a lot more potentially open to scrutiny now than they were 50 years ago, even if they might have been doing something very similar.
Well, have we gotten a little bit more jaded about it over the years? It just seems like, you know, we're fresh from so many scandals. I mean, Elliot Spitzer now is back being a pundit on these talk shows, you know, about the Wall Street situation. And you know, I've watched, you know, some of the interviews where, you know, women are interviewing him with, like, there's a dead elephant in the room, and they don't want to talk about it, and he's not going to bring it up. And it's just, I find it almost like the fourth wall has collapsed, where there's so much, and we're going to get into your work here in a minute, there's so much intersubjectivity that's gone on now where we get into the background, what goes on behind the curtain, where the social role people play is sort of fenestrated. It's like we can see through, like when Conan took over for Jay Leno a couple weeks ago, it was the whole backstory about, you know, how they met and everything. It's like we never knew this much information about a Johnny Carson or Walter Cronkite. These
no,
media
we absolutely
figures.
Did not. And besides that, if you, since you mentioned Jay Leno, if you recently watched any of his jaywalking episodes, people who take in what the media presents, which of course is some brain's opinion, because someone had to decide what they were going to focus on and what was important and what is the public going to get. So when they take that in, and then you ask them information that hasn't been put right out in front of them, but's available in books and available if you, you know, have in-depth conversations with people, they don't know any of that information. So your question about whether it impacts the brain, I think, speaks for itself when you see some of those interviews.
Yeah, people don't know who the, like, you know, the first president is, things like that, and who's on the $10 bill. And it's, you know, and again, he said that he never had to work more than about a half an hour to get the material he needed for the 3 or 4 minute segment he was going to do for the show, because people were so moronic. He was actually almost to the point of being stupefied that you know, literally, that people were that, you know, out of touch. And he says it got easier and easier over the years to get this done. And you know, I don't know what that suggests about, you know, our culture, but it definitely reveals that the superficial has become sort of almost kind of a metacognition. It's like we live on the surface on so many levels. And when you start dealing with a reflective or a contemplative or anything that requires – you know, an interiority, which kind of moves us from the objective to the subjective point of view, people get either bored or overwhelmed or lost. And it's like they have no ability to go in there, view something, come up with something meaningful and share it, because I think there's no reward for it.
Well, it's its own reward. And I think, you know, that's a generalization. And yet it probably is true for certainly a definite segment of the population, that their brains really do thrive and get energy on stimulation and jumping from one thing to another but not going too deeply with it, versus the types of brains that prefer less variety but really do want to go deeper. And in this culture, unlike several hundred years ago in the Middle Ages, for example, when the people who, you know, were more introverted and more internally pondering were the ones that could learn to read and write and do the illuminated manuscripts and all of that, there's probably not that level of reward for those kind of cognitive functions right now in our culture.
Now, do you think that's a result of science becoming so much the cultural standard for what counts? And science, of course, third-person science being so objective and so cut off from the observer that, you know, what's that expression, in God we trust, everyone else has to bring data.
I don't know that it's science per se. I believe that cultures in different time periods of this world's history have emphasized different things, and people go where the rewards are. So, you know, back to the Middle Ages, there were lots and lots and lots of cloistered religious orders, and not necessarily particularly religious, but cloistered thinking orders and writing orders and so on, because that's what was rewarded. Well, you don't have those today.
Right. Well, like I said, I think what happened was is that we got the population explosion, a lot of other things. We sort of dehumanized disease. We dehumanized healing. We dehumanized learning. You know, I always say, how are you ever going to get an integrated learning environment when you completely split up mental and physical learning into two different environments and have different standards?
Very difficult.
Then, yeah, and then ask the kid who doesn't have the wherewithal to monitor themselves to sit still in one room and run around in the other.
That's nuts because, you know, the latest research I have is that, you know, in studying adolescents especially, 50% of those brains learned when the body was vertical and moving. And so we're not talking about recess here, Mark. We're talking about getting up and moving while you learn. And the ship of education hasn't really caught up with that research yet.
Well, it's funny because there's been, I don't even know, 30 or 40 years of you know, this type of neuroscience research. We understand and know more about this little three-pound universe than we ever did, but we don't apply it. We leave it out there for the neuromarketers and all the unscrupulous operators to work off of. And it just seems like the basics of being able to use like a concept like multiple intelligences, like you were just talking about, when people learn in different physical environments, different sound, all kinds of different things are cues to learning, and we still have the same rigid structure we had, you know, 60, 70 years ago.
Well, because it's going to take a mass action, and it won't take that huge a percentage of people. You know, the research is if 5% of people get really committed, they can make amazing change. But when you look at education, just think what it is going to take to have all of those layers unfolded, new curriculum developed, the Congress stop saying, you know, you got to push every child on whether or not they've learned, and have a whole different paradigm for learning that addresses how the brain learns best. It's absolutely doable, but it's going to take something to accomplish that because people are vested in their jobs, especially in a recession. You know, they don't want to look at, ooh, how could we do this differently and how might that change the way I do things, and maybe they won't want my educational level for this, and people get afraid, and so they don't move. It's terribly unfortunate for all the brains that are being mishandled, if you want to use that word, but it's going to take some doing, and it's not going to be something that you just legislate. It's going to be people saying, you know, this isn't working. It hasn't worked for 50 years. Let's get serious about making this work.
Well, I think that's sort of the theme that we've been talking about for about a month or so now on the show. Different guests have come on with different perspectives, but it's this bottom-up grassroots sort of ethos that has to sort of supersede the, you know, the structure that the culture's been using sort of as a little cocoon, because we've gotten much more, you know, multicultural and multilingual and just a much more interactive and more world citizen base across the board, where you're at the point now, I think, where even things like the way we educate, you know, the whole special needs community, the last 20 years dealing with the way, you know, you didn't have a spectrum disorder 20 years ago. You were just in special needs. They didn't even give you a category. And now there's so many layers, even within, you know, one little aspect of it. If you're just in the Asperger section, you go over here. If you're LD, you go over there. And it just seems like that we've gotten to the point that almost like the way the music stores were before they all disappeared. They don't know they don't know where to put these music. The music is all fusing different styles, so they can't separate it. And so it's almost like we're going to need a new system to understand it, because I think we're really getting out of the mindset of trying to force people into categories and trying to look at them individually again and see how do I educate this kid? I used to have something called the JPEG rule when JPEGs were new, where you look at, like, my child's special needs, and he got there from paralysis of a vocal cord after heart surgery, so he only recently hit Denver 2, which is the exam they give them, was showing up with a spectrum number, was because he didn't have speech because he had a paralyzed vocal cord. So his file was about as thick as a local phone book with all kinds of, you know, different exams they did on him and all that. And so that would land on the desk of the head instructor every September, and they wouldn't, you know, mince words. They were like, they were intimidated. How are we going to, you know, deal with this kid? And everything became about sort of discipline and behavior, and all the the goals were much more about the way you would tame a small dog, because we weren't going to work on communication skills. We weren't going to work on emotional intelligence at all, because, you know, he's special needs. He's got this thing. And I used to put a picture, a JPEG picture, on top of his file, and I would sit down with all the different specialists, and I say, this is the child you're going to be educating for the next 9 months. This picture. Forget about the story in the file, because that's a bunch of filtered garbage that makes him fit into this binary universe that you guys have him assigned to. He lives in the gray. You have to educate him into the gray. And over the years, we've gotten, you know, a small percentage of the special needs instructors to adopt that strategy of being able to communally share standards, so that if he's going to go on a scooter and they're working about, you know, being aware of the seasons of the year, they would put different things in the corner of the room, and he would have different targets to go around to learn it that way, because he couldn't do it with the blackboard way.
Absolutely.
And that's been a complete uphill struggle over the years to get, even just for, you know, no child left behind. This is one child. This is mine. And on the other end of the spectrum, on the gifted end, where my daughter hangs out, it's much more about the kid being a discipline problem from being bored. And so they give them enrichment programs and more homework, and the kid gets burned out by the time they're 11 or 12, because, you know, they cognitively put them on a treadmill to keep them occupied.
Nobody likes it, Mark. The children don't like it. The teachers don't like it. The counselors don't like it. Nobody likes it because, hello, it doesn't work. But nobody really knows what to do to move it to a different model. We know how the brain learns best. We don't know how the brain learns. But there's research about how the brain learns best. And it's available, and some charter schools and, you know, some teachers are looking at aspects of it, but I don't know of any school district that's saying, okay, this is what we know about how the brain learns best. How many of those 15 little components, for example, can we get in this room to make a difference with these kids? I hope that happens in my lifetime.
And I think because the classroom sizes and there's been such bureaucracy put on every level, especially with the smaller kids, you know, the younger kids, to deal with the public versus the private versus the special needs versus the gifted programs. I just think there's not enough teachers trained in the neurology of learning. They're trained to deliver a protocol or a curriculum that the state sets a standard, and they teach to that. And what happens is that when you're doing a one-to-many setup like that, especially with that much variation now, where you didn't have as much maybe 30, 40 years ago, there's a big drop-off. It becomes very analog. And so you get the functionally, you know, illiterate child that gets pushed through the system, because basically the standard is such a wide filter that mediocrity is accepted as competent.
Well, I don't think that... You know, if you look at the schools, my mother was a school teacher. Look at how she was teaching school 50 or 60 years ago. Yeah, there probably were still 30 kids in the room, but there often weren't 30 supposedly 7-year-olds. You know, there were 30 kids, but there might be three or four other grades. And the older kids helped the younger kids, and the younger kids got exposed to different things at different levels. And I think that had some merit, because you take a look at 37-year-olds in terms of brain development, you don't have 37-year-olds. You've got 30 children who probably range in development of age from 5.5 to 8.5, and they don't have the variety that we used to have, because that was very good for some children.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see it a lot, especially in some of the schools over here in Connecticut, where they actually have, and they've done it a little bit here in New York too, where they have the older students teach the younger students, especially when it comes to computer skills and things like that, because the kid will accept information just like they would from an older sibling in that environment, like when it's technical, when it's about how to look, you know, manage the computer or do things like that. And that gives the older kids this very real sense of being able to show what they know.
If you can teach it, you do know it.
Yeah, I mean, but that seemed foreign to the education community until maybe 8-10 years ago, when they started, because of overcrowding, they started to lump the kids in the technology sector, because they had to teach these kids how to use all these different computers that were being donated. And they said, you know what, we're going to get, you know, the 6th, 7th, and 8th graders in the room here. We'll teach them all together. And then within minutes, the kids started to cluster around the ones that got it, and sometimes the 6th grader got it before the 8th grader, and it wasn't about this chronological thing. It was about this community of children that were able to educate
each other.
Yeah,
exactly.
And that goes on in every other environment you could name, but it's
except
just seems like, again,
for most schools.
Yes, exactly. So it just seems like the informal part of learning, the sort of the tacit knowledge, has sort of crept into the shadows here, but the explicit stuff that's been sort of rudimentary for the last, you know, 100 years or so. And now we've got to the point now where even things like that are hard science, like mathematics and science, literal stuff like that, issues have cropped up with things like intelligent design and creationism and religion and politics, things that were hardly ever discussed in the average social studies class. I mean, when I was in high school, social studies stopped, I think, in World War I. They never gave you anything from 1950 forward. It was basically just, you know, okay, we'll just skip over Vietnam and Korea. We don't want to talk about World War II even. And it was sort of just done to meet the curriculum for the test at the end of the year, where now there's a lot of current event stuff, and the kids are encouraged to kind of form their own opinion, back it up with information, present an argument, as they say, and, like, my daughter has a class that deals with rhetoric and deals with dogma and things like that. And she's, you know, she's a 7th grader, just finishing up 7th grade. So it's like she understands when she's hearing an idea versus a fact,
mm-hmm.
and making those distinctions. And that's important because, as you know, the brain is making that hard left turn there around, you know, 8, 10, 11 years old, when concrete learning is supposed to be, you know, the thing they're focusing on, and you get into some more abstract learning later on. A lot of these kids never got the concrete part. They just stayed up there, up in the semantic tree, abstracting and having a lot of generalizations. And when it came to actually making grounded, you know, observations, they're not able to do it. Like if I walked into a classroom around here, say a 3rd grade classroom, and I've done this over the years, you know, as my daughter progressed through, and I would say, close your eyes and picture your living room. A lot of the kids couldn't see anything when they closed their eyes. They couldn't see their living room. They couldn't picture anything. But if I said, you know, okay, you know, picture SpongeBob in your bedroom, then they saw everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because this is where they placed their attention for all these years, and they entrained it. I don't know how you undo it. How do you get the spyware out of these developing brains so that when they become mature brains, they're not still living in a digital sort of, you know, abstract universe, and they're living in a concrete world with us?
Well, one of the things that I think it's important to do, and that I did with my own kids, was we watched some television. But we did not watch the amount of television that the average children does. I read to them every night. We put models together. We played games. You know, we did other things that enhance internal active mental picturing. Mm-hmm. And the problem with a lot of television that's not balanced by these other activities is that we just enhance passive mental picturing, which means we are able to process what some other brain has created or espoused or projected, but we haven't developed the skills to do this internal mental picturing ourselves, where literally that is what you do. You close your eyes and you picture your room and you see what it looks like. You don't just picture something that someone else has created. And that's what you need for problem solving and, you know, creativity and all of those things that kind of aren't done with the facility and the amazing things you can do when you've got that internal mental picturing piece.
Yeah, and again, the culture's gotten hypervisual and really kind of hypokinesthetic.
Definitely.
So these are kids who are literally not in touch with their inner world except for pain and reflex protective things. When you deal with things that are, you know, I get kind of a little discouraged when you deal with just imagination and things like that, just concepts like that, like how relevant that is to someone's well-being, especially a developing child. These kids, I mean, I have a friend of mine who just says that the sickest part of any individual in this culture is their imagination. Their imagination has been taken away from them, and they don't feel that they have the input. They let the culture be the source for their imagination. They let the movies do it. They let all these other things externalize. And so when they have they reach a point, a nexus in their life, or something happens to them, there's no inner strategy. There's no other realm that they can go to for recourse. So where do they go? They go back to the medications. They go back to talking backwards into the problem in therapy. And they put up a lot of constructs around themselves where their persona is threatened, but them as an individual, it's almost like it doesn't happen to them. It happens to some disassociated part of themselves, and this leads to a lot of issues that you've been studying with respect to midlife and how we get from childhood to, because it's not, like I tell you a lot, we talk about it a lot here too, from cradle to 25 years old, the culture has a very regimented schedule for us. It tells us where to be, what to do, what we're supposed to achieve, and what the standard is.
What you're supposed to look like, you're supposed to eat. Unfortunately, the only way I know to combat that is one child at a time. You know, mm-hmm. we do what we can with the children around us, because mm-hmm. otherwise it's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, but from 25 on, once we're issued both an adult brain and an adult life, other than the mores of family and community and you know all the other institutions, the inner life is essentially neglected. And what happens is that the person goes from 25, say, to 45, sort of on whatever momentum they establish coming out of their early adulthood. And they get to a point where they reach what Eric Erickson talked about and Jung talked about, is this midlife crisis or this identity crisis. And a lot of the stuff that has gone on in the psychological literature, especially the newer stuff, neurobiology stuff, it deals with identity on this sort of physiological basis. And one of the guys that I study a lot, as far as the classic guys and then some of the new contemporary guys, deals with this identity thing as it relates to the biological wiring of the brain. And, Stephen Porges has done some research on it, and I've studied Trick and Burrow's work with respect to the I persona versus the true identity of the individual. And it's kind of the point now where, like, John Barisi's work is what comes to mind for me, because that's the one that I really kind of, settled into to apply, is that the early stages of life, when you don't really have the wherewithal to know where you're putting all this information, but your brain organizes around it, and Erickson gets into this over the course of a lifetime, is these stages of development. First year of life, the priority is bonding, and that is a level of attention that in Burrow's work is called philosomatic, which I'm referencing other people. This is where I get my sense of coherence, my sense of safety, right?
Which, unfortunately, mm-hmm. in the way our culture is now, with everybody, most everybody needing to work or being out of the
right.
home,
we lose that.
That doesn't always happen the way it really needs to happen.
Right, and as a lot of the researchers point out, you get this is where the origin of a lot of Asperger's comes in, because the bonding isn't complete, and there's what they call poor neuroception, and the individual doesn't feel safe in their environment biologically, so they can't create a narrative, because that second year of life, when you refer back to yourself and you become ontosomatic and deal more with your inner physiology and individuation, all the things that make the terrible two, if that coupling isn't clear, then you get sort of what I used to call a junkyard phyla, where you get this overprotective outer core and this undersupported inner core battling for supremacy. And then you get to the third year when now you're starting to get out of the reptilian brain, you're starting to get some right brain wiring, and you're starting to get a little more organized, and you get more emotional, and now you have a kid that has this very expansive, very untamed, imaginative realm, and, you know, they're sniffing the glue, and they're sticking their fingers in the light sockets, and they're getting lost in the department store, but they're not emotionally regulating, and so they become difficult to manage their behavior, and, of course, that's when, at 3 years old, is when early intervention begins, and they start to diagnose these kids as being, you know, bad apples, and they pickle them. By the time they get to four, if they've made it through that little obstacle course, the last stage in Barisi's work, it's exosomatic, where they can become system-oriented, because at four-year-old, the brain is able to actually tell the difference between past, present, and future, so it's able to lie and create alternative futures, alternative pasts, and see, oh, I can manipulate this adult and that adult, you know, and Chilton Pierce says 80% of the worldview is wired by 4 years old anyway. So we sort of learn how to move away from the family towards our peer group, out into the world, and then what? You hit the education system. So it's like when you see Erickson's work, you know, showing up in midlife, and Jung's work showing up in midlife, all those archetypal things that Myers-Briggs talks about, all the personality stuff, it sort of has its roots in this biological and physiological soup that started out earlier before you knew you even had a brain to think for yourself. And then when you refer back to it, you've already kind of encoded and internalized events along that terrain. So this is where we kind of have the Mobius strip turning inside out. The inner world becomes much more objectifiable, because now you're dealing with a lot with just memory. You know, and the way we sort information, the way we organize it, and the way we value it, and the way we weight it, and the whole science of memetics of how ideas go from brain to brain comes into play. And, you know, this is how we're sort of reproducing versions of ourselves in different environments. Like, I deal a lot with teenagers sometimes, and I say, you know, how many different nicknames and identities do you have between, you know, your text chatting and all the other things? And this sense of this sort of shattered self, this shattered digital self that doesn't relate to the biological self, I think that's actually established sort of a foothold on this newer generation that is very comfortable with having seven or eight or nine different personas out there on things like MySpace and Twitter. And they can be different people, but they're not responsible to any one of them. And I think it just leads to a lot of irrational, sort of unaccountable behavior, where you see almost every week we talk about some idiot has a party and they put all the hijinks up on Facebook thinking it's invisible and everyone sees it. It's like, and then they get arrested for it. So it's like, how do you get a brain that's been this distorted, this tricked by the culture, to think that it's living on the good side of a two-way mirror, to understand that the culture sees them and that there is responsibility, accountability, and maturity that is on the agenda, and it isn't just going to be just, you know, run every red light.
It's pretty frightening, because you're dealing not only with how that brain has been programmed, but you are also dealing with the rate at which that brain myelinates and actually develops,
mm-hmm.
and probably with at least three or four generations of cellular memory that, you know, pushes you toward behaviors because it's in your nucleus of your cell, but you don't have any cognitive way to evaluate that or define it. So you can get pushed toward behaviors that, if you haven't developed yet your own particular boundaries, you can get in trouble pretty quickly and then wonder, how did I get here? Because I don't think I chose that. And you probably didn't cognitively.
Right. There's a lot of non-conscious, unregulated behavior that goes on all the way through into the mid to late 20s. A lot of people, you see the remnants of it with the Lindsay Lohans and the Britney Spears and all these people out there now that almost get the positive reward for negative behavior from the culture, because once they release the sex tape, once they have the scandal, once they have the baby, they become more popular, where in the 50s and 60s they were exiled. They were never heard from again. It was like, you know, poof, and that was it. And we don't have, because of that tendency to be able to look behind the curtain and know way more information than we need to know about all these people, politicians, whatever, celebrities, athletes, whatever they are, there's a sense, almost like a unquenchable thirst to know these people almost more intimately than we would know our friends and neighbors and relatives.
Well, because it's safe, and I don't believe for a minute that everybody's like that out there.
No,
but
I just think it's culturally got sort of, it's got traction anyway. Otherwise, there wouldn't be so many people interested in all this.
Yeah, it's safe. You know, you don't really know them, but you know about them. Well, that's really not knowing someone. That's knowing whatever a group of people has put out there for you to know, and that may be what they're like. It may not be what they're like, but they don't know that because they, quote, know them, only they really don't know them, Mark.
No, exactly. They have a filtered, homogenized, packaged, completely agenda-driven version of them, you know, being propagated to them. And again, everywhere you see, because everyone now is a king, everyone now is a social entrepreneur online, where you can actually create and brand yourself. And we talked about this with Douglas Rushkoff, his book Life, Inc., about how the corporatism of the culture has now tricked the individual to think they could be sort of an emperor of their own little kingdom and create this sort of, you know, overlord of themselves that can then command the universe, when all they're doing basically is being exploited again.
Exactly.
And they don't see it. So it's like, you know, Erickson's life stage had 8 stages, and the stuff in your research has 8, so I just want to see if we match up. He starts out with the infant stage of hope, which is trust versus mistrust. And, you know, this is what we talked about before. Does the child believe the caregivers are reliable? Do I get the bonding done? And then you get to the toddler stage, where it's about will and autonomy and shame and doubt, and that's that second stage where I was talking about before, where you're ontophysiological and you're saying, I'll do it myself, and you're trying to break the bond that you formed in the first stage. Then you get to purpose, kindergarten age, and you're dealing with how to plan things. This is that exo thing where there's guilt and accountability and things like that, and you have initiative versus guilt. And then you get into around 6 to puberty, which is a big window. In Barisi's work, he talks about it as a transitive stage where you're trying on many different versions of yourself, and it deals with competence, industry versus inferiority. What am I good at? What am I not good at? And the emphasis is on the teacher in Erickson's work to make sure that the kid doesn't slip into focusing on the weak spots. If the kid starts to learn their strengths, they don't do that in education. They give you the opposite message of what you're not good at over and over again, and then they put you in you're a bluebird reader and you're this kind of reader, and the kid internalizes that identity, especially if the kid has, say the kid's a smart kid, but he suffers from asthma. Well, if the kid internalizes that because he's stigmatized, like we talked about last week with Dr. Young, if the kid has allergies and he can't have, you know, a certain food, he can't go to the birthday party, he can't have candy on Halloween, all those things that make him feel separate from the group create the sort of foment that identity that I'm different, I'm separate, I'm less. And if it's reinforced by education, healthcare community, parents, you know, the kid learns basically to sort of let that be their way in the world. Like, I'm not good at this, and I'm not good. And they don't try anything. And you see that, like, in a lot of these rec sports leagues where it's funny. They'll go from no competition at all to travel team, and then they cut you. So it's like the first time the kid experiences – you know, any type of failure, any type of loss, that comes at them blindsided when they're 13 or 14 years old, where the entire time before that, everything was even. So this whole thing of competency from 6 to puberty, it's a big, big window, is a big stage in development in Erickson's work, and it's critically important in this culture because that's when all the baggage gets put in. And then you get into teenager years with issues of identity and role confusion. He calls it fidelity. Who am I? How do I fit in? All that belonging stuff. That in Barisi's work takes you from 17 to about 25 when the adolescent brain is forming its narrative coherence, its life story based on those other experiences, and it has to face a lot of confusion because you're getting a lot of mixed messages between parents, peers, and prospective ways of being out in the world. And then when you get into young adulthood, intimate relationships, work, family, that whole stuff, it's you're now sorting out how am I going to settle down? How am I going to put a foundation down? Well, if you didn't get those first five things done, you know, by the time you get to number six here, intimacy becomes a threat. It becomes obligation. It becomes ritual. It becomes sort of disposable. And then you see the way kids deal with relationships now, they're almost competitive about it instead of compassionate. So you get a little more kind of impersonality to it. And then the last two, I don't know if you even have these left in the culture. Maybe you could answer to this. Caring, which is a verse with a generosity versus a stagnation, weighing your accomplishments and your failures, are you satisfied or not, assisting the younger generation, mentoring, things like that. And then wisdom, which might have gone out the window, which is dealing with integrity versus despair, handling death. Some people get bitter and unhappy, and some people can look at it and be more transcendental about it. They can reflect on the past. So all of that, that whole waveform there, goes back into core concepts of identity that I think have shifted in the culture because people are allowed or maybe even rewarded for having six or seven different constructed identities, and the real them doesn't come out until there's a crisis. And this is your work in this concept called past that gets into the personality profiles that you've been working with. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got involved with that and how you
Comment about your last comments there first, because a few years ago I wrote a book called Thresholds to Thriving, and it listed 24 developmental tasks that in my work I had identified as key underlying many problems that adults have with their behaviors. And so I wrote this book, and I did a lot of research, and I would take people through, you know, here are 24 developmental tasks. All right, let's talk about which ones you finished, which ones you only did partially. Now let's go back and finish those, because finishing those 24 tasks puts a floor under you, if you will, and allows you to become a healthy, functional, productive adult. It doesn't mean that everything in life is going to go well. It means that you have the tools that you need when things don't go well. Well, I still think that work is important, but I'm beginning to move toward the concept now that when you teach children about emotional intelligence, actually, a lot of what you're doing is helping them learn those developmental tasks. And so there's many different ways to talk about the same thing. And right now, I think we're starting to move with work, you know, by Goleman and Singh and some of these other landmark writers, researchers, that we're starting to talk about those things in a new way, and perhaps it's going to be more, I don't want to say palatable, but maybe easier for people to wrap around, if you will, so that when you start talking about emotional intelligence, you're talking about the ability to be empathetic, but at the same time to set your boundaries. You're talking about being able to take initiative, but at the same time be balanced, and so on and so forth. So I'm hopeful, Mark, that some of this work is going to make a difference, and the way I think it's going to make a difference is when some of these young people come to a place in their lives when life isn't working for them, they'll look for somebody whose life is working for them, and some of that role modeling of high level of emotional intelligence may be what gets their attention, because certainly the role models that the media are handing to them are not usually people that I perceive have high levels of emotional intelligence.
No, I mean, in fact, the opposite. You get a lot of superficial sort of quick fixes, Dr. Phil-like stuff, I guess, to give it a generic name, where there is no introspection at all. In fact, introspection is looked at as a weakness because it's looked at as self-indulgence rather than reflection at all. And again, it deals with the fact that we sort of push that away because it's a little bit more untamable. Right brain stuff is a little bit more, close to the bone, left brain, you can, like I said, you could desensitize and you could externalize it more. But how do we get, I mean, again,
well, it goes
with
back to Socrates, you know, the unexamined life is not worth living. Well, you talk to some of these people and they're not enjoying their life. And I think we do need to examine. All we have is our own brain's opinion. Yes, we can take mm-hmm. someone else's opinion and make it ours, but that's all we've got. And so I think it's critically important to examine, what opinions do we have? How have we absorbed them? Are they serving us well in life? Is life going the way we want it to go? If not, there's tons of things we can do, but it won't happen at a superficial level.
No, and again, this has been, it's almost like we might intellectually accept that, but when it becomes our turn on the diving board, it's a little more difficult to go, okay, I'll take my turn now, because it's a little bit squirrely when it's us. And I deal a lot with people in transition, whether it's work, career, family, relationships, whatever it is. And the constant sort of yearning is for balance. I just want balance in my life. And I say, this is a simple solution. Die. That's where there's balance. Otherwise, there's going to be dynamics. There's going to be a rhythm. There's going to be a cadence. There's going to be basically a flux. And you have to be able to center yourself in the eye of the storm and not get sucked into all this drama that is very inviting, but it just creates more imbalance because you're attempting to try to control something that isn't, not something you need to try to control. I always say there's two fears that people come into me with, and one is losing control, and the other one's realizing they didn't have it in the first place, which is usually met with a sort of a chagrin that they didn't expect to have. But I guess to get back to your work a little bit, we talked about Erickson before and his 8 stages that are out there for people to develop a healthy identity throughout life, different stages of life. What you're focused on in this work with PASS, which comes off of your work with the BTSA, personality assessment, is really dealing with the physical fallout from, as you say, living against someone's type. Discuss that, how you kind of stumbled upon that and how you organized that into a theory of this prolonged adaptation stress syndrome or PASS.
Well, it started when I was doing brain seminars and people would come to me and say things like, you know, life's not working for me. You know, I'm depressed, I'm fatigued, I have writer's block, you know, whatever. And I went to my doctor and my doctor said to me, have you ever had anything horrible happen to you in your life, or do you have any flashbacks? And they go, no, not been in, you know, Vietnam, not been raped, not, you know, abandoned when I was 2. And the doctor would say to them, you know, you look like you got post-traumatic stress syndrome, but you don't have an event and you don't have any flashbacks, so this is very strange. So they came to me and start, you know, multiple times people would say, can you help me? The doctors say that if I had an event and a flashback that I'd have post-traumatic stress disorder, but I don't. So I started keeping track of the types of complaints that people had. And then those who were willing to, I gave them the particular thinking styles assessment that I use. And it began to show that the more of these 8 symptoms I finally settled on, the more they had, the more likely they were to be what we call adapting, meaning spending large amounts of time every day on tasks and activities that took tremendous amounts of energy from their brain. And eventually they couldn't recover fast enough because of the energy drain. And then we got the work by Richard Hayer from his PET scan studies down in Southern California that showed that indeed people appear to have a chunk of tissue in their brains for which they will have an energy advantage. And they'll be able to do any task they want to develop throughout the rest of the brain, but it'll take 100 times more energy. So we started looking at this and beginning to correlate the symptoms with, you know, how they were using their brain. Were they using it in energy exhausting ways, or in energy efficient ways. And no, we don't have a huge sample to start with. We've got 400 plus and growing, but all progress starts with a new question, Mark. And, you know, I have a very small nonprofit corporation, and we're doing this on a small scale by asking some new questions related to brain energy expenditures. And what we are learning certainly is seeming to benefit these individuals. They're looking at things in a new way. It's no longer good or bad or right or wrong. It simply is, I have so much brain energy. How am I spending it every day? If you think of it as a brain bank of energy, am I taking this out most of the time at a dollar per second, or am I taking it out at $100 per second? And if you're spending most of your time taking it out at $100 per second, well, duh, it's not going to last as long.
And, well, again, this concept of just brain energy is fascinating to me because most, again, this is dealing with subjectivity, inner experience of our outer world. And, you know, the BTSA, the Benziger Thinking Styles Assessment, she dealt with this anecdotally as well, and dealing with the way people were basically distributing their energy. And you're dealing much more with how they're sort of clustering it and how and what the intensity is, and dealing much more with, it sounds like, state management.
Well, if let's say that, you know, we've got four chunks of tissue, which we appear to have, divided by natural fissures in that third neocortex, that third layer of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can help people, and they don't have to take the PTSA. I just am finishing up a new book with Gene Brewer, and we've got an assessment in there for just how to look at a task and decide if it's energy intensive or if it's energy efficient. And the collective wisdom seems to be that you want 51% of your life matched with what your brain does energy efficiently, which means you got 49% of your life to divide up any way you want. Yes, you're going to need to be doing some things that are going to take more energy because you just can't function in life using just a fourth of your brain if that were possible, metaphorically.
Mm-hmm.
But you can spend most of your time doing things that work for your brain, and the things that are more energy intensive, you sandwich those in between. And when you've spent a long time doing a task that you had to do and you're exhausted, the tendency is to go home, sit down in front of the TV and eat, you know, high energy, high fat, high sugar foods because you're tired, and the way your brain gets your attention is either making you irritable or making you hungry, if you will. And so you have a chance then to begin to analyze, woo, I just spent 4 hours doing that check balancing thing, and I know that's really energy intensive for my brain. You know, next month I'm going to break that up into 4 one-hour slots so that I don't end up being this fatigued at the end of 4 hours. And it can make a huge difference because your brain recovers more quickly and more easily. So what you're actually doing is you are using your brain by design. Instead of putting off all this, and what you procrastinate often, your brain knows how much energy it's going to take, Mark. And it will push you to procrastinate what takes a lot of energy. So we tend to put off all of those things. A certain number of them must be done at some point in time. Now we come and we're left with all of these tasks that have to be done by the 31st of the month or by the 15th of April or whatever.
And it's Lucy with the chocolates.
And we just get exhausted. So having at least some concept about you do have a choice to some degree about how you use your brain, and you can use it energy efficiently, or you can just, you know, use it energy inefficiently.
Yes.
And over time, you will pay a price. You will pay a price because excessive brain energy drain impacts the immune system. Now you're thinking about getting sick or autoimmune diseases. Now you can't do as easily and as well what you did before. And as you get older and you have less brain energy than you had when you were younger anyway, all of this stuff gets compounded. And so it looks like people can have a syndrome that is very much like post-traumatic stress, except there's no one event and there's no flashbacks, because year after year after year, they did what Jung said, they falsified type, meaning they made their brain work much more energy exhaustingly than they could have had they known how to do something different. And it starts, of course, with figuring out to the best of your ability what kinds of things are energy efficient for your brain. And then you can go from there. And, you know, I'm only one person, and I can't do everything, Mark, but
well,
you're
applying your own work right there.
I can do something, and that something is what I'm doing.
You know, when someone is as authentic as you, externalizing to the listeners that, you know, I'm going to put this model out. You guys fill in the ice cube tray with information, because what you're creating here is a very fertile ground, because most people treat their lives and their brains and their bodies like rent-a-cars, like almost like I said before, like everything's disposable and replaceable. And they lean on the system, education system, healthcare system, even the government, to sort of be their kickstand. And then when they realize that they've overstepped and gone, you know, past the point of no return, and now they're getting some of these symptoms, the fatigue, the hypervigilance, the immune system suppression, you know, some of the things you talk about as far as the markers of this syndrome, it becomes sort of an accepted part of aging.
Not okay. It's not part of healthy aging, Mark.
No, I mean, we talk about a lot. You know, it's after the age of 30, more than 0.5% decline in function is artificial. It's lifestyle related. It's the way you're governing yourself. So what we talk about in somatics is the concept of living in the rhythm, which means to recognize what, you know, Sigmund Mihaly talks about as your flow state, what comes natural to you, what you don't spend a lot of energy doing. And it could be, like, you go back to those four that I talk about, the philo is an interpersonal type of individual that relies on coherence from relationships. So if they're not around, if they're not in a people-based job, if they're cut off from people, they're dealing a lot with, you know, computers and interfaces, and they're not interacting, they start to get drained. Where an onto physiologically based person deals with decisions and ideas and more the cognitive aspect of life and creative stuff, more interior focused in the visual the way that they process, and they like authority, and they like to be much more kind of, the target is very close to the task, so they can be like a woodpecker and get things done. So they're much more energetic and kind of spiky in the way that their rhythm is. And then you have us ecos like me that are empathic and kind of staccato in their rhythm, where one day they'll work for 6 hours straight, the next day they'll be playing hooky. And that doesn't fit in a 9-to-5 universe. So you get your artists and your musicians and your creative people and your night owls, and they're all over the place. And then you get those 9% as the exos that are very square and extremely, you know, kind of technologically bound and very system-oriented, and they don't have a big interiority. They're much more system operators and technical people that love to work behind the scenes. When you put them in a position of being a manager of people, people don't behave, machines behave, and they get stressed out. And this whole concept of allostasis and allostatic overload, which the industrial psychologists talk about a lot, where you're dealing with a million jobs that have a lot of responsibility but very little reward, and they get burned out, and you end up in your 40s dealing with all these things you're talking about, changes in neurochemistry and the memory problems and the depression and the self-esteem issues that lands them in a Prozac nation or a similar country, and they expect to be there. So, again, your stuff is dealing with, like I talk about, the taboo of subjectivity. There's a great book about that you talked about the sample size in your study. You talked about some other factors that limit what you can do individually. Is there an interdisciplinary platform that is looking at this as a broad spectrum thing, not just necessarily what you're identifying as past, but this process where the culture is squeezing the biological juice out of us individually and collectively because of the fact that we don't know what our type is until we've become dysfunctional?
I don't know of any effort. I know of individual people like me who are doing what we can do to raise awareness. Every time, you know, it's like dropping a pebble into a pond. One person gets it, and they impact their whole family and their friends, and that's the only way I know of to do it at this point. And I don't get too locked into, you know, there's lots of models. I have a very broad model, if you want to call it a model, the Who Am I pyramid. You know, I want to use plain, ordinary language. I want to talk to people in words that they get it. I want them to learn how to finish a task and evaluate how much energy it took as compared to two or three other different types of tasks. And I want them to feel empowered that they have a brain that is unique. We don't believe there are two brains on the planet that are identical. And they can muddle through life, or they can do what they can to understand what we can about the brain and live by design. And sometimes people come up to me and say, oh, we don't know anything about the brain. And I go, we only know a little teeny bit about the brain. You're absolutely correct. But we know light years more about it than we did 500 years ago. So let's take what we have with what we know now and apply it as absolutely practically as we can. And in 50 years, we're going to know more than we know now. But meantime, you could have an entirely different 50 years if you want to take responsibility for figuring out what you can about your brain and then doing something about it, not just taking the victim stance and saying, oh, everybody expects this, this, and this of me. I can't do anything. Oh, absolutely. Yes, you can. It is your brain, so use it by design.
Well, you're so genuine in your message here, and I always try to make it a little bit more of a palatable process for people. I talk about recreational recovery because the focus is always on doing. In this culture, you got to do this and do that and do this and do that. And I usually focus on how people undo things and how they do things, because that's where they become real again. That's where the brain takes over. It'll procrastinate for you, and it'll put tasks off that are going to tax it too much. And what I find is that over time is that people will recognize themselves in the unhook stage than in the hooked in stage from activity, and they get reflective because they're able to see themselves, and what you're talking about here is a very, you know, it's a very attractive tangibility that there isn't about finding the perfect, you know, exercise program or the
absolutely
or the, you know,
not
all the religious pursuit of the pure diet and all the things that people try to put on themselves, sort of like, you know, painting over all their mistakes and having the salvation through whatever modality has come down the street. This is about personal authenticity that doesn't have to be approved by the rest of the universe. And you know, I think that's one of the things that we take away from tonight's discussion about how do you take something that is something, I guess it's going to be expanding as we go if we don't address it, this past type of a process where there's a prolonged adaptation stress syndrome in the culture, that we can use these tools that you're talking about that are under the category of kitchen table wisdom. They have a timeless quality to them that every culture's used over the years. But our culture, because it's much more focused on exertion than recovery, there's no joy in it. There's just more work. And I just see if you focus on outlets and you focus on things that could be sort of almost kind of synergized as opposed to synthesized, I think you get where you want to go with what you're talking about, where people won't let themselves burn out because there's a John Henry sort of system that applies that if you're not exerting yourself to your absolute wit's end and burning yourself into a crisp, you're just not trying hard enough. You don't really want it.
And, you know, when people start getting it, Mark, when they finally have a day or even a few hours when they experience that sense of how easy something is because it matches their energy expenditure advantage, you know, they look at you with the deer in the headlights look and go, oh, I like this. I understand now what you're talking about. I don't want to go back to the other way I was living. And, you know, it's just like you eat an elephant one bite at a time.
Mm-hmm. If people want an immediate change that's going to last, you know, a lifetime without any effort, again, this is it's sort of the contradiction in the culture. They, when it comes to the to this type of process, they don't want to lift a finger, but everything else, they'll run through a wall for it. You know, whether you look at the way the game show mentality or the reality show mentality of trying to get famous, you know, look at the way people trip over themselves to get on American Idol, to chase that pinata. It just seems like we have a system that looks at things through a very, very distorted mirror, and the things you put out tonight are easily recognized by anyone listening that's experienced any one of these things you discussed, the fatigue, the immune system stuff, where they've been searching from the outside for what's being delivered to them from the inside. And this concept of brain energy, I really want to come back to this someday and maybe get another guest in here to talk about it with you kind of eavesdropping in, because I just see that the neuroscience is going much, much more towards talking about energy, not just based on physiological stuff, not just based on stuff that could be quantified, but how the person feels inside, the affect, what goes on.
Well, it probably can be to some degree. We just don't have the tools yet. But, you know, Richard Hayer says that your energy advantage occurs because in this chunk of your brain, whichever it is for you, you have a reduced resistance to the transmission of information across the synapse or the synaptic gap between mm-hmm. neurons. So there may actually be a chemical neurotransmitter advantage that is what gives you, and it may not give you energy, it just may be that it happens with so little energy that you feel like you're getting more. Does that make sense?
Well, for a change, you're going downhill rather than uphill, so it's
exactly.
not as
exactly.
Yeah, the gradient changes.
You come home exhausted because you've worked all day as an accountant, and that part of the brain really doesn't have your energy advantage, and you're too tired to do anything, so you watch TV and overeat or drink. Well, if you change that and you come home and you have a plan to do something that your brain does easily that will re-energize you, it's amazing. Within 30 minutes, all of a sudden you feel like I have more energy than when I left work. This is wonderful. And it's a process of being aware of what happens in your brain and body and moving toward what feels good, moving away from what feels bad, and learning how to do that in an effective, productive manner that's not going to have negative consequences for anyone. Now, that's also high emotional intelligence.
Yeah, and again, the simple math of this is organizing your life, so 51% of your activities accentuate that, and that's not... You're not asking for an 80-20.
It's absolutely doable. 51 is doable, Mark.
Yeah, and most people are living without that knowledge, and they're living, say, 60-40 against themselves or 30-70
80-20 or whatever.
Yeah, and that's what lands them in rehab and makes them do a lot of self-destructive behavior in the brain's attempt to stop the body from destroying itself. You get a lot of these antisocial behaviors that the people literally look... They look and act helpless because they aren't aware of what it would take to balance them. But, you know, like I just talked about in this developmental model of the brain that we use, is that, like me as an eco, it's my temporal lobe. So I know that just the simple act of putting on music, just the simple act of getting into my limbic system will center me, where it would drive someone who's exosomatic, who lives in their occipital lobe, absolutely stark raving crazy. So it's like... You know, it's
but if you don't know that about yourself,
right.
then you can't do that by design.
Right, because again, people live on the outside of their system, so they'll blame their boss or their mother-in-law or their neighbor or, you know, something external to them that they have no influence over, rather than knowing, it's like knowing what nourishes you. Like a lot of things that come out, you know, to get underneath the personality and deal with the physiological rhythms underneath and deal with things that are even based on what time of day you work and what kind, what, how long a vacation a person needs. As an eco, I know I'm staccato, so I can't have a steady rhythm. Like anyone puts me into a block of work where it's going to be the same thing all the time, I'll burn out within 2 weeks, where someone who's more a smooth rhythm person, that's a philosomatic person, will draw off the energy ambiently of other people, and they'll stay afloat, and they like to be in a flocking mentality anyway. So they can handle that. Or the exo who can work in a very digital fashion for blocks of time and come in and out of those rhythms. So all those things, the ultradian rhythms, the circadian rhythms, the infradian rhythms, there's so many rhythms. It's almost like I said, we know all this stuff, but now we're at the age of actually trying to apply it so that we can get more human potential out there and not have to keep fishing people out of the river because the culture keeps throwing them in. I don't know if the culture really cares. So the stuff I talked about last week with Dr. Young, he's done, I think, 500,000 live blood slides of people's blood components, and he said there's only two blood types, healthy and sick. And he's got about 5 science degrees and 40,000 cases, and the conventional community, because they don't understand this systemic look at the human body, denies that information being valid because they're treating conditions and diseases that you say precipitate from this ignorance of self-knowledge.
Well, unfortunately, we train our experts to only take care of people after they're sick with symptoms. And I would wish I would live long enough to be able to help people understand that you can prevent so much of this if, as Socrates says, you know yourself. I mean, it's so basic. And then we would still need some allopathic medicine, of course.
For emergencies and stuff, yeah, and extreme conditions. But we rely on it over-the-counter 24/7. It to me, it creates this artificial sense of security that, of course, leads to all the
misuse and
all the abuses that we see propagated through. We're having a memorial for Michael Jackson, who was a philo, by the way, and had a very horrible childhood that's well documented. And he spent most of his adult life fishing in his own brain for that security that he never got.
Yeah, and the problem every brain needs and wants to feel good. And that's the reason we have neurotransmitters like serotonin to help us avoid sadness, being able to live at joy, dopamine, so that we feel wonderful. Well, if you are exhausting your brain, you still want to feel good. And the only way that brain is going to feel good is by using usually some type of addictive process that's going to manipulate at least dopamine, serotonin, and endorphins. And so it's really not about us and them and good and bad. It's about this brain doesn't feel good. It's trying to feel good. The only way it knows at this point to do that is to get involved with something that's going to change those neurotransmitters. And unfortunately, with people like Michael Jackson, you give them something to help them be alert, and then you give them something to try to help them fall asleep.
Yeah,
he lives
in a bottle.
And they're antagonistic often to each other. And so when you think of your brain as a pot of chemical stew, and it really is, Mark, it's a pot of chemical stew, and we choose how we're going to season it by what we eat, what we drink, whether we exercise, how much sleep we get, our thinking style, and then, of course, anything that we take as a substance. We can't control much, but we really can control a lot if you think of it in the sense that, okay, I've got this chemical stew here, and I'm responsible to some degree for how I season that. That's quite a bit of control, Mark.
And the feedback comes through efficiency, productivity, the sense of being centered. And Ta-Nehisi calls it the sense of coherence, manageability, comprehensibility, and meaningfulness, and all these things we look for,
Learning that, it's such a better way to live that, I mean, how do you even describe that to somebody? There's hardly anything that knocks you off center. Bad things happen, you know how to deal with it. But most of the time, you are seasoning your chemical stew in a way that you are content, productive, energetic, know how to set your boundaries, have good levels of emotional intelligence. I mean, that's a pretty good way to live, Mark.
Well, I believe me, we aspire to it here in summertime and I'm very grateful for your contribution tonight. Hopefully people can listen back to parts or all of the show and get some of the wisdom that was between the lines there in the conversation. Your books are just adorable to me because they take these very, very heavy, sometimes sort of overwhelming concepts, and you bring them right down to where people can apply them, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, I welcome you back on the show anytime. And there are no misconceptions tonight. Usually I save the misconception question for last. But just go to arlenetaylor.com or .org. I don't have it in front of me.
arlenetaylor.org.
.org, and just feast your eyes there, because she has organized a website that will have you visiting that and plucking little fruits off the tree, near My God to Thee is played. So you've done the work, and I really admire your spirit, because you're very dedicated to getting people – not to force them to be aware of this, but to make it so that it's tenable to them and it's not overwhelming. Because you say the word brain to people and they glaze over and they think it's, well, unless I'm having a stroke or I'm having Alzheimer's or something is, you know, life-threatening, I'll deal with that later. But this is dealing with the brain on its much, much more rudimentary level, where you're dealing with, just like you said, lifestyle and quality of experience and these things that are aesthetic and have a very real contribution to making people's lives. So I amazing stuff, and hopefully we'll go back and forth a little more and share our work a little bit more, because I think we can really bridge a lot of gaps here between these different factions that have been, you know, drawbridges for generations now.
That's great, Mark. It's always it's always interesting to talk to your brain. I think my brain likes to talk to your brain.
Well, we'll keep it there, and we'll meet again soon when we have some more data for your side and more for mine, and we'll keep batting across the net at each other that we figure something out, and have a great 4th of July, and we'll talk to you down the line.
Great. Take care.
Take care now. Okay, so here goes Arlene. Eventually, there goes the computer. Okay. So, again, real quick recap tonight, because we talked so long, is that a lot of the stuff that she's mentioning is buried in between a lot of the different labels that are out there. So I think Deepak's back. Let's see.
At the end of these reports of possible abuse of prescription drugs and people trying to intervene to stop this, and a live-in doctor, which you've probably heard the LA Times reporter say, had been brought in by the promoter of this concert.
Well, you know, in 2005, Michael came to spend a week with me in San Diego after his trial was over, and he asked me for a prescription for narcotics, for OxyContin, actually. And I was quite shocked, and then I started to quiz him a little bit, and it became obvious to me that he was taking these substances and they were being prescribed by various physicians. When I started to really probe, he became very defensive.
Okay, so Deepak's still dealing with that loss, but he has something to say right before we go here.
Yes, Mark, I was listening to the interview with Arlene, and I want to contribute a little at the end of the show.
Okay. Go ahead, Deepak, fire away.
Well, after the show is over, I welcome you to my abode to partake from some camel and some couscous to balance the evening, because I extremely enjoy your scintillating discussion.
Well, I'm going to have some pizza, so you can do what you want, but like I said, you're welcome anytime.
Thank you. Go in peace.
All right, then. So there you go, Deepak checking in at the end. Completely lost my mind. And anyway, next week we're going to be getting some real woo, some real old school woo with our good friend, the fabulous, the talented, and the irascible David Goodman. So that's coming up. Can't wait for that animal to walk through the walls with us, because he's going to make with this stuff this week look like an introduction. Unbelievable stuff. So let's head out the door with a little Peter Gabriel. We'll see you again next week on Summertime at 9 p.m. in the East and everywhere else in the West. Thank you for joining us. Be yourselves and be well. Have a great and healthy 4th of July. Let's get those Phillies. Living in the rhythm, baby. You've been coming through. I'm gonna feel you.
Travel light.